Hey guys, welcome to the Safe Space Podcast. You're with your host Emma and
Hester.
We're going to dive into some Berlin tapes that we recorded the other week.
When we were in Berlin, we went to Pride, obviously. Yeah. But it was probably quite an important thing to do some research on the history of queerness in Germany.
Yeah, and it's iconic, I must say.
It is. It's iconic. Also filled with tragedy and horrific things happened to queer people over time.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really fascinating to read some of the stories that are so beautiful from the queer people who actually existed at the time.
Yeah. And to hold their legacy on.
Yeah. And what we did is we stood in the spaces that we were reading about. So when we told the stories to each other, we stood in the spaces that were significant.
Yeah.
And that felt good, didn't it?
Oh, it felt incredible. Because it was just so crazy because it was just me and you stood there doing this little podcast and all that history had happened in that space.
Yeah.
And we were retelling that history with the potential of you guys to find out about it and potentially go there yourself.
Very spiritual, wasn't it?
So, what have we got on today's show, Hester?
So, I'm going to start by telling the story of Magnus Hirschfeld.
Lovely.
We've done many a story about Magnus.
Yeah, he's an icon.
He is. It was really, really good to delve into like his history and all of his achievements and his life and the things that he researched and the things that he did. Would have made such a difference to us had history not have gone how it did.
Definitely so. I hope you enjoy that, guys. We also have the Holocaust Memorial for Homosexuals. We talked about that, didn't we? We went to that.
We went to that. A very powerful memorial, that.
It was, gosh, it kind of looms over you. And it heavy. Because they're all consuming. You feel so small compared to them.
It's pretty something else, isn't it? And the Memorial for Homosexuals was beautiful inside, like preserving all those memories of people that were erased.
Yeah, yeah. I was stunned. I was completely speechless.
It was very powerful. Yeah. And if you do go to Berlin, go and get down there.
Definitely. We also tell the heartbreaking story of Lily Wust and Felice. You're gonna have to help me with this name.
Schragenheim.
Great name. Which really broke my heart when I first heard this, Hess.
Yeah.
You delivered it beautifully.
I mean, like, I researched it and it was really hard to research. I got very emotional researching it.
Mm.
It was really hard to sort of put that story together. Those two. It's a really special story and I'm surprised I'd not heard about it before, really. Have you ever heard of the German Jewish doctor that opened a gender-affirming clinic here in Berlin? It's not here anymore.
Okay.
In 1919.
Is this who I think it is?
Magnus Hirschfeld.
My guy, Magnus.
Now, Magnus pioneered some of the most important research in sexuality and gender over 100 years ago. So Berlin was the epicenter of queer culture and nightlife. And he was a big name about the town. They called him Aunt Magnesia. And people from all around the world would come to him for advice regarding sexuality and gender issues.
Okay, so he was like the doctor to go to.
He was the guy. In fact, the enormously popular cabaret song, Das Lila Lied, written in 1920, was dedicated to Magnus.
No way.
It translates as the Lavender Song. And I want you to read a little line from it, because it's basically the first LGBT anthem.
We are just different from the others, who have loved only in lockstep of morality, and who are only up to the banal. We are all children of a different kind of world. We only love the lavender night, which is sultry, because we are just different from the others. Beautiful.
Magnus believed that gay and trans people could be liberated through the tools of science. And he opened the Institute for Sexual Science right here. Now, the centre had a museum which contained artefacts, things like ancient dildos from Japan.
That's incredible. So not only was it like an actual place for healthcare, it was also a place for history.
Yeah, baby. So yeah, the centre provided counselling services, sexual health advice, and it was a social space for queer people to congregate, especially for trans people. He also performed some of the first gender-affirming surgeries, which were very risky at the time.
Incredibly risky, but incredibly brave.
Now, Hirschfeld believed that gender and sexuality manifest themselves on four different levels. Sexual organs, physical characteristics, sexual desire, and psychology. And on these four scales, each person could be situated somewhere between male and female, instead of the two categories, men and women.
Wow, so seeing it like a spectrum.
Which for the time, pretty revolutionary.
Very revolutionary.
So Hirschfeld emphasised the importance of seeing a person's unique gender and sexual identity. And at the same time, in 1933, the Nazis were gaining immense popularity.
Oh, God.
Hirschfeld and the Institute became targets, and it became increasingly clear
that anything that stood in the Nazis' way was going to be eradicated.
And on May the 6th, in 1933, while Magnus was in Switzerland, the Nazis ransacked the Institute for Sexual Science. They stole thousands of books, research papers, and artifacts, and a few days later, these books, along with many others, were burnt in the square.
Right here?
Right here. So 40,000 people gathered that night to hear Joseph Goebbels give a speech here, and he declared that these books were of an un-German spirit and demanded their destruction.
That's crazy.
Now, it is thought that the destruction of this research set back the queer community 40 years in terms of knowledge and progress. I don't think we should underestimate this moment, because it was this moment that young people in Germany were being taught that their salvation lies in the erasure and silencing of others. So we have to remember that when art or literature or research is prevented from being published, and words are no longer allowed to be used, and people are no longer allowed to be who they are in public, we start to relearn that silencing and erasing people we don't agree with or we don't understand is a solution. But the truth is, that idea can only lead to violence and destruction.
The way you've put that is just perfect.
This is the memorial to all the books that were burnt that day.
Oh my word.
By Jewish writers and gay writers, liberal writers, socialist writers. And this is where they would have all sat, if you can see.
Oh,
the empty bookshelves.
That's insane. It's like the empty library.
That's what it's called, the Memorial of the Empty Library.
Is it?
Mm.
Magnus.
Magnus. Big respect to Magnus.
Uh-huh.
I think he was such an interesting character and did so much in his life. And a lot of the people who worked with him did as well, you know. I think he also, apparently he went around the world and studied different, like, gender identities of colonized countries and things like that, and really tried to understand the spectrum and the difference in gender. And to do that at that moment, as a Jewish doctor, facing the persecution that he did face. As a gay man, he was not an out gay man, but he, like a lot of people, historians believe he was gay. Yeah, I think his mind must have been so open. But I think that's also the time in Germany.
Yeah.
People's minds were open.
Yeah.
The Weimar Republic and the queerness of that time. Mm-hmm. People would come from all over Europe to be in Berlin to explore their genders and sexualities. And so he was a product of his time as well. Like, we can't give him full credit for that, because a lot of people were experimenting, and through that experimentation he studied it, you know. Like, he would go to gay bars in Berlin and meet people and study them and try and come up with theories for why their existence is credible. But yeah, it would have been so amazing to see those archives and the institute and all of his research, if it hadn't been destroyed in the way it was.
I would love to have met him and sat down and talked to him and say, why did you decide to do this? What kind of stories have you heard? Why you find it important? I just want to interview him. What I really respect about him is his ability to create safe space.
And bring people's stories to the forefront, you know, bring people's identities and ideas to the forefront of his research, rather than, you know, just measuring statistics. Like, he actually measured people as people, which is cool.
Very, very cool. When you look at his, I've Googled his books and stuff, and seen the Third Sex Berlin, like, that was one of his titles he had. Like, he, it sounds awful, but it feels like that was someone that wrote a book yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, that sounds like, feels like revolutionary in today's world,
yeah,
let alone in 1920s. You just can't even fathom that was rocking off the shelves of Berlin. Well, thank you, Hester, for that story.
That's all right, Em. Emma.
Yep.
Have you ever heard of the heartbreaking lesbian love affair between a Nazi sympathiser and a Jewish freedom fighter here in Germany? Lily Wust was born in Berlin, 1913, just before World War I. Lily didn't express much interest in politics, and she celebrated her 20th birthday when Hitler was elected Chancellor of Germany. Around the same time, Lily fell in love with a man who was a Nazi sympathiser, and they married shortly after. Much to the dismay of her parents, who were actually communists and were very sceptical about the new regime.
Understandably. Yes, understandably.
Now, Lily was comfortable turning a blind eye to the horrors that were unfolding around her.
Oh, Lily.
Until she met Felice.
And who was Felice?
So Lily met Felice through her housemaid, Inga Wolf. Inga was actively fighting the Nazi system and was a German supporter of the Jewish underground. Mm-hmm. And by 1942, Jewish life in Berlin had gotten increasingly unbearable and dangerous. So thousands of Jews were being deported to concentration camps. Many fled, and those that didn't went underground. Some went into hiding, and others were able to pass as non-Jewish, changed their names, and lived openly in Nazi Germany. One of those people was Felice Schargenheim.
And they fell in love.
So Felice was a bit of a risk taker, didn't avoid dangerous situations. She was part of a circle of women, along with Inga, who worked underground, helping Jews flee the country.
Extremely brave.
Yeah. But Lily and Felice met in November 1942, here in Berlin.
Oh, wow.
Not exactly here.
Not here.
Here in Berlin.
Yeah.
When Lily decided to join Inga for coffee. Lily described the meeting saying, "There was an immediate attraction and we flirted outrageously. I began to feel alive as I never had before."
That's, wow. I've had that once.
Stop it, you stuffy sod. And Felice fell pretty hard too. She showered Lily with flowers, compliments, letters and poems. Gay as fuck.
A very gay queer love at its finest.
Makes you want to step your game up a little bit.
It does. Makes me want to get some flowers, write a poem.
All the while, Lily had no idea that Felice was Jewish or part of the resistance against the Nazis.
So like a hidden identity.
Must have been quite scary for Felice.
Felice. Oh, 100%. I can imagine it would be very, very scary for Felice.
Yeah. Now, in March the next year, Lily was taken into hospital with dental sepsis. And Felice bought red roses every day. And for the first time, Lily allowed Felice a glimpse at her real, true feelings inside. At this point in the hospital, they fell madly in love. And that same month, they had a secret wedding ceremony. Now, they wrote their own wedding vows. And I'd like you to read them to me, Emma.
"I will always love you. I will never leave you. I will do everything to make you happy. I will, as far as circumstances allow it, take care of you and your children. I will not protest against you taking care of me. I will not look at pretty girls anymore, at most to determine that you're prettier. I will rarely come home late at night. I will try to grind my teeth quietly at night. I will always love you. I will always love you. Until further notice, Felice."
Fucking cute.
They found love in the little moments of life.
Mm-hmm. So, Lily's husband has moved to the Eastern Front and Felice moved in.
U-Haul lesbians at its finest.
Felice would often disappear for days at a time to carry out her underground activities to enable Jews to escape. However, one night, Lily, who knew nothing about her double life, had a huge argument with Felice, frustrated at not knowing where she'd been this whole time. Imagine him. Going out all the time, she doesn't know where she's
going.
You would be paranoid, but she's about to be sorely mistaken. Lily said, "She told me she was a Jew, and immediately I took her in my arms and I loved her even more."
Oh my word. True love.
They cried together all night and spent the next few months together, fearing nighttime noises and unexpected knocks at the door. They spent their days in the flat looking after the children, talking about literature and politics, and Lily even supported Felice's underground activities, wanting nothing more to keep her safe.
Wow, it's very, very sweet, beautiful.
In 1943, Lily's husband eventually died on the Eastern Front. Felice and Lily lived and loved in hiding for months. But on the 21st of August in 1943, they packed a picnic and went to the lake. There, using a self-timer, they took the only picture that exists of the two of them alone, embracing and kissing each other in bathing suits. It's sweet, huh?
They are the most gorgeous pictures I've ever seen.
It's true.
On their return to the flat, however, 8 Gestapo sprang out of the shadows and carted Felice away. Felice was imprisoned in various concentration camps, but somehow she managed to smuggle out letters to Lily, signing them "Your caged jaguar" and promising to be home soon.
Promising to be home soon.
Lily even, at one point, went to the camps in an attempt to rescue Felice, but she was thrown out by the prison guard. Felice sent her last letter ever on Boxing Day in 1944. She wrote, "I love you very, very much. You, your parents, and the boys. All my love, Jaguar." It took Lily a further 4 years to discover that Felice had died, probably of tuberculosis, just 5 days later.
So what happened to Lily after that?
Well, Lily said, "I was alone for years. For about 3 decades, I lived totally within myself. Only on Sundays did I allow myself the privilege of thinking about Felice, and I have never stopped loving her." Until the 1980s, Lily began to talk openly about their story together. She said, "I suddenly felt that I owed it to Felice so that people would know who she was."
She's finally letting her love be heard.
Yeah, and actually in 1999, there was a movie made about them.
Oh my gosh, really?
Called Amy and the Jaguar, which was their like pet names together.
Oh my word.
And these are some last words from Lily that she said at 89. She said, "Twice since she's left, I've felt her breath and her warm presence next to me. I dream that we will meet again. I live in hope."
truly breaks my heart every time I hear that, Hester. Can't lie.
And the pictures of them.
Oh.
I mean, I'm so glad we have those pictures because that shows you everything that they meant to each other.
Mm.
They're so, like, tender. And, like, they're still, the words are still held in the Queer Museum in Berlin.
Yes.
The vows. So you can also go and see that. And they were just beautiful, weren't they?
I think their story is just so a story of love and how love can conquer all.
And also how, in the story, Lily starts out as a Nazi sympathiser.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly, like, she changes her mind. Like, okay, I think we all think we would be resistant to the Nazis,
mm-hmm.
looking back on it.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, you saw how many people did go along with things and didn't take a stand. And it's not until Lily meets Felice, who obviously she falls in love with her and she is like completely overblown by that love, but also she understands her reasoning for resisting. She understands, like, she understands what's happening at that moment, that she starts to understand
mm-hmm.
that Felice is Jewish, and it changes her entire action in the world she was living in. So, like,
it annoys me because it takes that falling in love and having that personal empathy to it that makes you change. Like, why couldn't she just have tapped into that before?
Well, I think that was what I found really interesting about it in itself, you know, like, is that there's obviously blind spots to all of our empathy that we all have. It's not until maybe something hits personally, not until we experience something, if it's love or if it's something else, that we can actually stand up for what's right and stand up for other people and, like, justice and peace and things like that. But there are so many people that will go around not, like, allowing... Like, we have the treatment of refugees in Europe at the moment.
Yeah.
It has been compared by many people to the way the Nazis originally talked about Jewish people in the Holocaust. You can do with that statement what you want, but, like, dehumanizing people to the extent that you will mistreat them and breach their human rights and violently create systems against them is not happening in our world. And it makes you just think, what are you doing?
Yeah. What's it going to take for them to do something?
Mm-hmm. For all of us to do something. Yeah. So I think you can look at these two and see Lily's transformation.
Yeah.
As, you know, a kick up the arse sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
It's just such a beautiful love that they found. That kind of love that everyone wants to find.
Oh, it's just beautiful. You could feel in the photos and in the story, you can feel the love they have for each other.
Yeah, and how they want to so protect deep. Each other.
Yeah. The vows were just beautiful.
Yeah, and funny.
Mm.
And
delicate. I did want to say as well that one thing that interests me about this story is that obviously the Gestapo came for Felice because she was Jewish. Why didn't they get them both because they were homosexuals? Was it well hidden?
I think at that time, women living together would not make people think they're homosexual.
Yeah.
I also think the Nazis' persecution of homosexuals was predominantly men.
Yeah.
And gender non-conforming people.
Yeah.
I think a lot of lesbians did die in the Holocaust as well, but I don't think it was as much as a assumed thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that, that saved Lily, but also Lily's husband was a soldier, a Nazi soldier, who died on the Eastern Front.
Mm-hmm.
And she also, I think, got an award at some point for being, like, a mother of Germany, which was, like, an award that the Nazi Party gave out to women who had children of German soldiers. So, like, I think she had a level of protection because of that.
Right.
A level of sort of, like, yeah.
Interesting. She lived to be quite old, didn't she? 89, did you say?
89 is the last statement I read from her. I'm not sure exactly when she lived until, but I don't think it was that long after that. She found later in life that she wanted to share that story.
Yeah.
And that's not an uncommon occurrence. I think a lot of gay couples are starting to share their stories even now from those times and what they went through. And that, like, it's so much more important that we bring that alive again, you know, because they didn't get to live that in life itself, you know.
Mm. Well, thank you, Hester, for talking and sharing that beautiful story of Felice and Lily.
The final story we told is about the persecution of the homosexuals in the Holocaust. Please listen, because it's important.
We are at the memorial for homosexuals that were persecuted by the Nazis. So in 1933,
in Nazi Germany, queer people went from being scared to being constantly at risk. It was at this point that the Nazis mounted a vicious campaign against homosexuality and anything that could be conceived as a threat to German birth rate.
What did they do at that point?
This was followed by ruthless laws used to eradicate homosexuality. The Gestapo started to round up gay men. It is thought that their names and addresses, the Nazis found at Magnus Hirschfeld's Institute for Sexual Science, were used as evidence against queer people around the city. So tens of thousands of people were taken to concentration camps. Some took their own lives as the Nazis advanced across Europe, and some survived. After the war, it was not recognised by Western states that the fate of so many queer people being systemically murdered was an injustice.
That's something you never hear about, what happened after the war.
Mm-hmm.
I know that homosexuals were persecuted,
yeah,
by the Nazis, but what happened to them after?
West Germany adopted the same law that the Nazis had used to persecute queer people, and their persecution continued. This history of queer liberation in Berlin, of people being themselves, exploring themselves and their diversity, has been lost.
We don't know what happened to them, do we?
We don't know all their names. We don't know about their hopes and dreams, of their love stories. However, to know that they existed, that they organised, celebrated and loved in this space together right under our feet is something we should never forget or take for granted.
And that's why I think it's really important that we have this memorial.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, there should be so much more. There are archives, there are things that we need to learn.
Stories.
Exactly. That's why these stories are so important. Whatever the Nazis wanted to do to them, to erase them,
yeah,
is never going to happen.
I think this is probably my favourite memorial I've ever seen. But I think what I really liked about this is that it was really obtuse and powerful. And then you peer in and you see the delicate stories inside.
It's just really shocking to think about the persecution of homosexuals, because after the war, they would then continue to be persecuted in the West and the East, you know, and that's like, to have lived in that level of fear throughout Nazi Germany and throughout Europe, and then for it to have ended and to be liberated from those places, but then to continue to be persecuted, it's something I'll never understand. And I really want to learn more about stories of people who've gone through that, because I think going through that amount of trauma and persecution is something we have to learn about in order to make sure none of us contribute to it again. There's actually a really good film called Nelly and Nadine, who were a lesbian couple who met in a concentration camp and found each other after the war.
Wow.
And lived out their lives together. It's a beautiful documentary. It's so powerful. So I'd really check that out. Also, El Dorado on Netflix is also a great watch if you want to learn more about Magnus Hirschfeld, the persecution of homosexual people, and transgender identity that was happening in the 1920s, 30s, 40s.
Thank you, Hester.
Yeah, obviously there's a lot in this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, take your care after it, because it's a lot to hear. It was a lot for us to read about. It was a lot for us to research.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so important to learn about. And it's just so important that we know that, like, this life we live now has been lived before and was destroyed before. It's about, no, we have to make sure this never happens again.
Yeah, completely. The legacy of these people live on through the stories we tell.
Mm-hmm.
Through the history we tell.
And thank you, Felice. And thank you, Lily. And thank you, Magnus. And thank you, everyone else. Because we learned so much from you. All right, Em.
Okay, Hess.
It's time to wrap this up.
Thanks, guys, for listening.
Lots of love.
Lots of love.